when I call you Christopher. It's so rare. Christopher?
Christopher.
It always
you used to go by Christopher Straub. I remember that back in the day.
I did it in the beginning to make people think that I was a man, not a girl.
Oh.
Because Chris, everybody thought it was a girl's name. Although, looking back on it now, that would have been maybe helpful if people thought that a beautiful woman was making these great comics.
Can I tell you, it actually still adds to my enjoyment of Star Slip to imagine that.
I still feel like a beautiful woman is making Star Slip.
I gotta tell you though, Chris, having just video Skyped with you, that's the fullest beard I've ever seen on you. Are you going at full force on that? Are you going to hold?
I guess so. I did it because I didn't want to trim it down and clean it up, and that kind of de facto becomes a beard. Beards are a product of laziness, David.
Yeah. But you're now like 2 weeks away from having a giant loping grizzly be your best friend.
Yeah, I need to get an axe to sling over one shoulder.
I'm glad that Brad at least remembered that show. That's great.
And some theme music. It's some theme music that involves whistling in the background. That was Grizzly Adams, a staple.
Oh, Grizzly Adams. Yeah.
Yeah.
With Gentle Ben, right? Wasn't that his name?
Yep.
It was, yeah, it was Ben. Well, Gentle Ben was a whole nother TV show.
Oh, I'm totally absent on this one.
Oh, you remember Grizzly Adams, certainly.
Hold on, let me take a peek.
Wasn't Grizzly Adams' bear named Gentle Ben? What was Grizzly Adams' bear name?
He had a bear. It might have been Ben.
No, but Gentle Ben is a children's author.
No, it was the Grizzler.
No, that sounds like a really, really bad knockoff restaurant. Grizzler. We've got steaks, kind of.
It's grizzly.
Okay, Grizzly Adams. Although the bear in a subsequent television series, The Life and Times of Grizzly Adams, is also named Ben, there is no connection between the bears. I love that they have to put that little addendum. There is no connection.
Remember Mad Jack?
Mad Jack,
the guy with the white beard that was
It was the guy that played Uncle Jesse from The Dukes of Hazzard, and he was like a prospector.
The Great Denver Pile.
Yeah.
Oh.
I can only do that because I've got Wikipedia up in front of me, but yes.
Oh, man.
And did that play right back to back with BJ and the Bear, or am I condensing my 80s TV?
And bears. Like they just hit a lot of. They had one bear.
Let me ask you this:
no, bear was a monkey.
you know how when you're a kid you don't.
Well, that was a budget constraint.
the animal trainer role shows up with this truck. He's like, "Sorry guys, you only paid $5,000. This is what you get."
You know how when you're a child you don't differentiate between characters and actors. Like, that guy might as well be Grizzly Adams.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think I ever connected an actor to that character. Like, I mean, I just always assumed he was Grizzly Adams. Who is the actor?
I don't know.
Dan Haggerty. What did he ever do before and after?
He was probably a mid-tier WWF wrestler, and they're like, "Hey,
here, you know how IMDb will take the most known for, and then you can see their full filmography. He's most known for The Life and Times of Grizzly Adams, Grizzly Mountain, Escape the Grizzly Mountain, and The Capture of Grizzly Adams." He did nothing else.
And then the final one is he's most known for Escape to Grizzly Mountain, Grizzly Adams, and subsequent alcoholism.
Famed for.
I thought that was much funnier than you guys gave that credit for. Never mind.
Wilderness loving man must clear himself of a wrongful murder charge and rescue his daughter, who may be sent to an orphanage. Wow, June Lockhart was in that as... Anyhow.
Well, that's a lot like webcomics.
That'll work.
That's how about that for a transition?
That's as good a segue
I'm
as any.
Going to broadcast live this Webcomics Weekly.
Oh, I was about to, just for the purposes of recording, but you do it because you got the official account.
How does that work? Where do people go?
I'm going to tweet it.
Oh, okay.
I'm just using my normal stream.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I see.
Just so long as you record it. I've recorded this entire conversation, but I get nervous.
Well, I've recorded it too with Audio Hijack Pro. Hold on a second. Broadcasting.
Well, I started my day with Frosted Mini Wheats.
Come on, Scott, you can type.
Come on, guys.
Nope. Apparently I can't. Hey, Liz Taylor died.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how I feel about it, because I don't care about Liz Taylor.
Why not?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
You know what? I would say that most of what she accomplished was accomplished well before we were born.
I think so, too.
Probably.
Well, yeah, you know what's funny about a life like that is what's the guy that did the radio adaptation of War of the Worlds and did
Orson Welles?
Orson Welles. Like, she kind of had a life like Orson Welles in that you're always sort of chasing the early successes, you know?
Well, I mean, she suffered from having not died, right? Like, Marilyn Monroe did these amazing movies that she's famous for, and then she died, and she's forever immortalized young. I guess Elvis is the same way. He started to get old. But, I mean, Elizabeth Taylor was an award-winning actress. Woolf, Cat in a Hot Tin Roof, Giants, Cleopatra.
Well, that's what I mean, though. Taylor. Like, compare her to, like, her life and Orson Welles. It's like, had they died when they were 35, bam, they would be forever known as these, like, perfect artists. You know, it's like, yeah. You know, but by living on, it's like, oh, well.
Yeah, yeah, now, I mean, there have been lots of other.
She's the fat woman that sells fragrances.
Right, and Orson Welles sold fish sticks. You know, I mean, that's the sad truth of it.
But there were lots of celebrities from that era who just kind of retreated to private life. That she kind of stayed in front, or at least as in front as you can be.
Well, but you know. she was a philanthropist too. She was one of the first people to start raising money for AIDS before anyone would ever talk about it.
Mm.
Because Rock Hudson died from it, and she was the first person to really start raising money for that.
That's significant.
It is significant. But you know, we only know the jokey kind of version of her.
Yeah.
You know what's happening now is people are taking that and running with it and owning it like Shatner.
Right, right. Like, and that's probably the best way to handle it. Like, you know what's amazing me to think about with Shatner's career is that he was like in early Twilight Zones. Like, that is going so far back.
So if you watch – we watched Boston Legal religiously. I don't know if you guys ever watched Boston Legal. But there was an episode of Boston Legal where he was reliving his first case, and they took old footage from an old Outer Limits or something of a young Shatner.
As a lawyer?
As a lawyer arguing a case.
No way.
Yeah, and one of the old men from – the only thing we know him from is Trading Places. You know how there was that old guy in Don Amici? Were the two guys that was Mortimer and – do you remember Trading Places?
Oh, right. Yeah.
So the silver-haired guy in that was his father and was saying, you know, was wanting to compromise his principles, and Shatner would not compromise his principles as a lawyer. So they took that old – I don't know what it was. It wasn't an Outer Limits. It was something. It was like a – it was a non-science fiction venue-driven TV show or not venue, vignette. Like every week was a different story. But it was him and his father, and the episode was that some guy breaks into Crane, Poole, and Schmidt and takes everyone hostage and forces him to retry the case so that his father's name can be cleared, or his name can be cleared. And he's remembering his first case and his father, and they're playing that old footage as a flashback.
That's a clever TV trick, though, to be able to employ that.
You know where else they do that is on – do you guys watch Castle?
No, sadly.
Well, so Castle, on that show, his mother is played by the woman that used to be on Dharma and Greg as Dharma's mom or as Greg's mom. You know, the kind of older rich lady. Her name's Susan Sullivan. But anyway, she's been on a ton of stuff. She's been on Falcon Crest. She plays Nouveau Reach pretty well.
Right, right, okay.
And she plays Nick Castle's mom, who is a retired actress. So every once in a while, they will show her looking at old footage of her career, and it's from the actress's career.
That's funny.
So it's like he comes in and she's watching herself on the old Incredible Hulk show. And she's super young and he's changing and she's like, "No, David, don't change." And then Castle's like, "Oh, watching your greatest hits." And she goes, "I always thought I was great on this episode, you know." That's and it's awesome. It's fucking her when she was young. It's great.
You know what's great about that from an actress standpoint? She gets paid not only for filming that Castle, but also for the use of her old stuff on the Incredible Hulk. That's awesome.
Yep. Yep. I think this episode we should show something from when I was on Sergeant Bilko. Yeah,
exactly. My car needs a new transmission. I'd love an old royalty payment. How much would you make from that?
Yeah,
from an old show, it would only be in the hundreds or thousands for an old stuff, because it's already, you got to remember, it's been running in syndication or on re-airing for a ton. Like, it gets smaller and smaller every time something re-airs. Does that make sense?
Oh, so it's depreciating.
Yeah, it's a sliding scale as it shows and shows and shows.
Oh, wow. Wow.
But there are, you know, it's still huge sums for the first few showings of everything, so.
I believe this episode of The Incredible Hulk still has 58 cents in it.
Well, there's a bar, or used to be a bar out in Malibu called, what was it called, Chris? You might know it, called Derivatives or something, where if you got a check for under a dollar for a TV show that you were in at one point, you could come out and give them the check and they would give you a free beer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know if it still exists, but it's somewhere out in Malibu. I don't remember. It's somewhere out there.
Hey, is Brad still with us, or do we lose him?
Oh, no!
Brad? Well, why wouldn't he say something?
Well, maybe he can't say anything because he's still on the call.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Now I can hear you.
I've been trying to. Well, it's my own fault. I hit the mute button on accident on my thing. But I've been trying to jump in with conversations like from the beginning, and I'm like, these fuckers won't let me talk.
That is a horrible feeling.
I had. Did you hear my Grizzly Adams stuff?
Some of it, yeah.
Oh. You're like, I went for 10 minutes on Grizzly Adams.
I had a great riff on Grizzly Adams. I had Elizabeth Taylor shouting about Gladiator at the Academy Awards.
None of it.
Christ.
No, Brad, none of it.
All right, start over.
We're doing it live. Brad, the best part about that was the caveat where you had to admit, you're like, well, all right, so I muted myself, but you guys missed it.
No, that takes a lot of courage. I would have just said, I think something was wrong with my computer equipment.
I guarantee you right now that each one of us was like, Brad hasn't laughed in a long time.
Well, I noticed, the reason why I noticed is I thought, you know what, I haven't said anything in a while. I really don't have anything to say about this stuff. These guys are, you know what, Brad hasn't said anything either.
Well, all right, so are we ready to tuck into this?
Yes.
God, I hope everyone else.
Can I actually suggest something? Because I think Brad will be a good influence on the conversation. Is that I would love to, because it's so often that either Scotty or I start first, but I would love Brad to start first on.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm on board with that.
Because I think Brad will have a nice moderating influence on us.
Well, okay. Here's the topic we want to talk about, and that is the thing that's on everybody.
God damn it, Brad! Introduce the podcast.
Oh. Officially.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Webcomics Weekly. This is my big shot. I'm getting the chills. You're listening to Webcomics Weekly, and it's great to be back again. Christ, somebody else do it. I'm so bad at it.
No, just, you did it. You're done. You already
there.
Did it.
You're in it, buddy. You know what? You've already wet the pants leg.
You might, you might as well empty your bladder.
All right. Why don't we introduce ourselves?
God.
Why is this so tough?
I don't know. I understand. I am choked. Go ahead and introduce ourselves.
All right. Hey, I'm Chris Straub. I make Starslip at Chainsaw Zoo. Next. Wait, you know what would be good is if we put our credentials up there. Like maybe what's not important is which strips we make, but how long we've been doing it. This is my 11th year.
Ooh, wow.
Take that. Next.
Bam. All right. I'm Dave. I've been doing Drive for 2.5 years now, I guess, 2 years. Been doing Sheldon for, 11, 12 years? And before that, did another strip called Four Food Groups the Apocalypse for 5 years.
Ooh.
So that's what I've been doing. I like how sotto voce that became. Oh, so
well,
that's nice.
I guess it yeah. feels good.
That, you know what it became a little bit? It's like, oh, poo. Mm.
Scott Kurtz, been doing PvP for 30, over 3,000 strips, 1,000 character blog entries spanning 15 characters, 28 books, 599 dead whores, a New Yorker piece rejected. Six stores. Oh. PvP for 13. Brad and I were talking about this earlier as I was driving into work.
Who's Brad?
Brad Geiger. Tiger's
how long has he been doing it?
I've been doing Evil Incorporated for 11 years and Courting Disaster for I think 4 or 5 years. Fables ran for a year and a half.
Mm.
And how long Greystone Inn?
Well, Greystone Inn is part of that 11 years that I attribute to Evil Incorporated, since it was kind of like a prequel, if you will.
It's the same universe.
Right. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, Scott. Should we jump into it, or do you want to go into that story, Scott? Because either one of them are good introductions.
What story? What are you talking about?
You were just going to start in about how you and Brad were talking about longevity or something related to years.
Oh. Brad and I were talking about my first published work. A cartoonist named Brian Denham was doing a comic for Antarctic Press called American Woman, and he was drawing it. My friend Richard was writing it. They were telling me about it. Brian lived in Dallas, and he had worked for Extreme Comics for a while. He broke in at Image and lived in California for a year, but he had returned. And so Antarctic Press was down in San Antonio, and he had this chance to do a comic. An American Woman is like a female Captain America who got her powers from the level of patriotism in the country. So the more people believed in America, the more people believed in America, the more her powers were good. Right.
That's such a Reagan era comic. Just if I could stop for a second, that's amazing.
Yeah, no, it's really funny. I mean, this was post 9/11 and everything. So.
Oh, was it? Oh, okay.
Oh yeah, this was like 97, 96.
That's not post 9/11 though.
Or it's pre 9/11. I didn't mean to say.
Oh, okay.
I apologize.
Oh, okay.
This was pre 9/11. God, I'm so used to hearing post 9/11 that it just came out.
It just comes out naturally now.
Yeah. But this was before 9/11, and so the villain in the first issue was there was an overarching story arc villain that was kind of like the antithesis of her. So it was a person who wanted to breed, I guess, anti-patriotism, but just like not belief in your country or whatever. So she was kind of in the background on this other plane. And then there were superhero villains. And the first superhero villain he introduced was this villain called the Mime, who could mime something out and it would become real if enough people believed in it, right? So So, like, if he shot you with his invisible gun and you believed him, you would die from bullets that were, you know. And so the issue one came out and it sold like 9,000 copies and it was a huge hit. And
when you capture a supervillain like that, do you take him to jail or do you just put him in this invisible box?
Oh,
that's my good, ladies and gentlemen. I think that's for the week right there. I think we're done.
So issue two comes out. Issue two comes out, and you have to understand that my friend Richard, who's writing this, is just so excited. I mean, he's always wanted to be in comics. He's got a wife. He's got a kid on the way, and this comic is selling quite crazy. And this could lead to, you know, not just money, but maybe work at Marvel and stuff. And so issue two comes out, and the story was supposed to be that the mime was miming in front of a crowd that he was building a bomb, and American Woman has to stop him. But the bomb was going to go off. The bomb was going to go off and destroy Times Square, and it was going to – the country was going to kind of lose faith in American Woman a little bit, and her powers were going to dwindle. So that was going to be the conflict. And it was a 20-page comic, 21-22. Brian drew it. The pages come in. When the bomb explodes, the world blows up. And it says, whoa, is this the end of American Woman? We'll find out maybe one day. The end. And he just ended the comic. So the pages come in, and it's 16 pages, and the bomb goes off, and the world explodes. Not Times Square. The planet.
But why? How is that allowed?
Denim didn't want to draw it. Denim was like, oh, no, I hate this idea. I want to do a different idea. It's a horror comic. And if it's – if I didn't think this was going to go anywhere, but if it's selling, I'd rather draw something I like.
Right. And the first issue of American Woman had sold really well, correct?
Yeah.
This was a success.
For an independent comic selling out of San Antonio, Texas – in the 90s, it was like 9,000-10,000 copies. Yeah.
That is a horrible story.
And he just was like, I'm going to do this other thing. I want to write this thing called, it was a horror comic. And he had done all this amazing artwork. And we're like, Brian, you know, you've got something that people like, just run with it. And he's like, nope. I'm going to do this next thing. It's going to be even better. And he just wrecked that friendship with Richard, I think. But like, the book came out and it just ended. Issue number two is like, the end. No one believes in American Woman anymore. The end. And so the reason why I bring this up is because they had 4 pages to fill. They had to get it to 20 pages, and they offered me 4 pages to put my comics in. And this was back before PvP had started, and I was doing those little Samwise comics about the medieval bard and Skull. And so I gave them a 4-page story, which they printed out of order.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a flip cover. So this is what Brad was saying was, you know, I was a year married, trying to break into comics, desperate to. They offered me the back cover. It was going to be a flip cover. So you could go to I could go to the comic book shops and flip the comic over, and it would look like my comic.
Right.
And I could also hand it to people when I was trying to sell my work and say, here's a comic, and hand them the front of it, and it would look like I had a comic published by Antarctic Press.
Yeah.
And this was issue two of a title that had already had a very, very good, strong release in issue one.
Well, so I don't know how many people in the industry knew about it, but certainly it was selling well. It could have if he had continued it, it could have done really well. But I knew it was over when I got the opportunity, because the opportunity came to me because Denim was fucking up,
right?
And they wanted me to fill the pages. And so we were like, Brian, God, you know, do just keep going, you know, I mean, please. And so it was this thing where the issue comes in, and it's disappointing enough that this guy can draw as well as he can. I mean, I couldn't draw superheroes. I couldn't draw a comic like that to save my life. I could barely draw the 4 pages I needed to. And I'm up on my computer because my computer, they needed it at a certain output on a computer disk that my computer couldn't handle. It needed to be like 400 or 600 DPI or something, and it needed to be in color, and Photoshop would crash every time it tried to save it. So I'm up the night before, and I would color it and hit save, and it would crash, and I'd open the file again, and Photoshop would open the black and white file barely, and I'd start to color it, and then I'd save it, and it would crash saving it. And it took me – it was like 4 in the morning, and I finished. And I slept for an hour or two, and then we drove to San Antonio, and I slept the whole way to get it done. And then the pages were printed out of order, and I couldn't even show it to anybody. And here he was. He had a 9,000 copy on the first issue sale comic, and he was just walking away from it. And I was miserable.
And Scott's telling me this story this morning. We're just talking about any number of different things. And actually, the way it started was we were talking about a completely different subject, and it became this goes back to like 95 and his first trip to San Diego and who he met there and going on from there. And basically that there was a lot of false starts before PvP came up. And this was one of the false starts. And we're just talking about that, like prehistory. And I said, you realize this is the perfect way to open up the show today. And he goes, well, why? And I'm like, well, this is all about kind of having success and then dealing with the conflict between creativity and commerce. And that's really what we're talking about today, because the big news in webcomics is that Chris Onstat, who does Akewood, has posted a blog dated Sunday, March 20th, that explains that Akewood is going on an indefinite hiatus. And I don't know. Do we need to go into the actual blog itself? I would imagine most of our listeners have already read it or know where they can go to read it. But it basically talks about him quitting Akewood because he finds himself writing the same jokes over and over again. He finds himself retreading new ground. There's a creativity conflict there. And he talks about wanting to try new projects. He mentions a novel that he wants to write. He will continue to do subscriber content. But Akewood, as we know it, which is, what, a 10-year comic, I believe. It's another one of these comics that's been around for a long, long time. It's going to come to an end. And, of course, Chris is somebody that we have discussed in earlier podcasts, just to put some reference to this, because one of the things that brought him across our radar was that he was not running ads on his site, and then he found himself, after having been named Time Magazine's Graphic Novelist of the Year, 2007?
Yeah.
After having tremendous critical acclaim, I would imagine to be immense traffic. He was not running ads on his site, and he ended up within the last year or so asking for donations, which at the time we kind of questioned whether that, you know, it's like, well, if you're not running ads, then you're going to find yourself in this position. But he had a creative conflict with running ads.
Right.
So that sets the table for the discussion today, which is not – and let's put this right out there. I don't think that we're talking about Chris per se, but we're talking about the conflict of creativity and commerce that all of us have to deal with. Is that a pretty good way of opening this up?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to frame it.
Yeah, and you know what? I would even put a tiny addendum on it. It's also just the conflict of creativity itself. You know what I mean? Just how you operate.
That too. Yeah, that's a big deal. And I made a big blog post following it, talking about creativity versus commerce. So basically, I don't have anything to say. no, but it's the idea that. I know that I've done this, certainly, and I think that maybe Onstat had done this, but he was saying that maybe in feeling like he's not pushing his writing, that he's cheating somebody somehow, and he wanted to get out of it. At least that's what I got out of part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
wait, what? He felt like he was cheating?
Well, no, I'm saying
like just like shortchanging in a way.
Oh, right. He was saying that he felt like he'd write something and then he'd feel like, well, I'm just mimicking the voice of this strip. I'm not writing this originally anymore. I'm just like copying what I've done already.
Yeah,
and he felt like, well, that's no good. I can't do that. But I would say, yeah, but in any long-running strip, ultimately that kind of stuff happens. Like running gags develop. You get to know what the character reaction to certain things is. And it even becomes something that fans demand. They want to see that.
Like the panda, for example.
Yeah.
Right. You're not doing panda jokes and saying, God, this is so cheap. I'm going to stop doing PvP. I run it into the ground.
No, I would never do that. But I do say I don't want to do panda attack jokes anymore. But I just found new ways for there to be conflicts with Brent and the panda.
Right.
Right.
Well, that's what I was saying the other day. Is the same thing that Chris was saying. Of course, in a long-running comic, you're going to have the similar themes pop up because you're the same guy writing them. And you're going to have the same stuff kind of coming across your brain. And the challenge in terms of creativity is bringing something new to it. You know, there's lots of new things. Just think about how much the world has changed in 10 years. Some of those themes that you hit in 2001, you could hit again in 2011, and it's a completely new framework to hit them in.
Yeah. I don't know why that is. I mean, and I think it does have to do with creative versus commerce, where you don't want to just be producing the same piece of work over and over and over again and selling it to people.
Right.
But I get concerned when I think that there's a hesitance to make money on your work.
And you know, do you think that's happening here?
That's a, like a 100-year-old concern among artists. Like before 100 years ago, that wasn't a problem. Like, you desperately wanted to make money off of your work before 100 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But somehow this idealistic notion that an artist shouldn't be profiting off their work developed in the sense that once commercial art started to happen, like advertising, illustrated work, that sort of stuff, once commercial work started happening, there was like this divergence in art that you cheapened your art if you accepted money for it or if you somehow pursued money with it. That only critical response, only audience response, maybe not even that, maybe just personal response was the only thing that mattered. That was the pure artist. But that's only a concern that's about 100 years old. Prior to that, people were like, oh, man, I'd sure love to eat. Hey, you want to buy this painting? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, exactly. Well, or
before that, artists were people that were supported by patrons.
Right. Right, but even then you had to shuffle to, you know, if the Medicis weren't buying, you had to go down the road to a different Italian family, you know? So you still had to work for it a little bit, and you were still desperate to get that support, you know?
That's true. Nobody said, hey, you know what, I love your art, and I want to be your patron. I'm going to pay for you to decorate this church. And you say, no, I will not accept money for this.
Right. This is a pure...
I'll do it for free and starve, but I won't take your money.
I can understand that happening, and, you know, when I was in college, there was a big divide existed between two floors in our art department, and that was the second floor of the art building was the fine art degrees, and the third floor was the commercial art degrees, and there was a big divide.
Mm-hmm.
And we called them the Black Lungers because I was up in the commercial art floor, and we called the people on the second floor the Black Lungers because there was a fine layer of that black charcoal on everything on the fine art floor, because that's where all the, you know, your first 2 years of classes were drawing things with that black, those black.
Oh, those sticks of charcoal.
Sticks of charcoal.
Yeah. How do you feel about carbon? Cause you're going to be drawn with it for the next 2 years.
It was everywhere, but I don't understand what happened now. I mean, it's this very odd subset of ridiculous criteria set up by commercial artists. I mean, Chris Onstad is a commercial artist.
Right.
So now
he doesn't want to be. It seems like it's a bigger conflict
than him, though, is that people that don't want to be seen or don't want commercialism in any way to impact their art, you know?
Well, yeah, but they're commercial artists. This already happened. That's what I'm saying. It's a bunch of hipster bullshit, too, because this happened at Emerald City Con.
Here we go.
at the Emerald City Con, Chris Baldwin, who does a really amazing comic now called Space Trawler, his first book just came out, and he brought me over a copy of the book. I was really excited, and I'm like, oh, I just can't wait to tuck into this, you know? And he said, oh, thank you. And I said, how's it doing? And he goes, well, you know, it's doing better than my other stuff. And I said, well, are you enjoying it? And he goes, oh, yeah, working with color has just been so much fun. And he, you know, and I said, yeah, it's great. And he says, I've been avoiding it for so long. And I said, yeah, it's time consuming. And he goes, well, no, not because of that. It's just that, I mean, I've been avoiding it because if you're not, it just feels like if you're not black and white, you're not truly an independent artist. And I wanted to jump up and punch him in the face, like constructively, as if to say, God damn it, Chris, here, poof, wake up.
Did you get a copy of that book too, Chris?
No, I did not.
I did.
I've seen it.
It's beautiful. It's a great read. I really enjoy it.
Awesome. It's so much fun. That book is so much fun.
It's really great. It's really well crafted. But if it you're not me, too black and white, you didn't tell me that at Emerald City. I didn't hear that story.
But it hurt me in the heart. Chris Baldwin spent any amount of time.
Can I tell you the business
sitting
at a aspect
cafe of me debating it, like going, oh, but if I do color, I'm not truly an artist. Like, someone just pet him. Like, just hug him and let him know it's going to be okay.
Especially with his skill at color.
Yeah, yeah, that's the worst part.
But, it's like Billy Elliot and dancing.
Can I tell you how 180 I was on when you were leading into that? When you said, like, he was like, yeah, I've been holding back on color. My immediate thought in my brain was, oh, yeah, because it doubles the cost of your books, right? And then you were like, no, because it cheapens you as an independent artist. What? No, God, no.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think the bigger issue that I come away from a lot of these attitudes is not that I don't want to be commercial. Because I think if a lot of this sentiment, if you drill down on it, it's that they want to make a living. They just want someone to cut a check to them, you know?
Well that's how is that living made is the question.
But that's what I mean. As long as the hands don't get dirty, it's like I don't care how that sausage was made. Just put it on my plate, you know?
Right.
I just
there's a buffer between you and your money.
Right. Right. And somehow that's cleaner. Somehow that's purer. Somehow that doesn't soil the artist's heart as much, you know.
Going back to your example about being a Renaissance painter and looking for the Medicis and so forth. The other part of that is that if you're in that position where you're getting money directly from your patrons, like we are, it becomes very important. Those patrons become very important to you. And this wasn't something that I picked up in this particular blog post that we've been kind of poring over, but once it was pointed out to me, it became glaring, and that is during this announcement that Akewood is going to end, there's never a moment taken to thank the readers.
He doesn't say thank you once. He in fact he's very antagonistic towards his readers in this blog post. And I really have a problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at one point, he even says, everything I've ever done for Akewood has been free, so I don't want to hear any bitching that it's going away. It's essentially what he says. And, it'd be one thing if the guy came out and said, guys, I've been doing Akewood for 10 years, and when I get up every day and create, I want to create something that I'm excited about, and I wish it was different. But right now, this is not exciting me. The idea of prose is exciting me and writing a novel. And that's what I want to write. And thank you so much for Akewood. And thank you so much for these last 10 years. And I'm going to write novels now. And I hope you'll enjoy them too. And I think I'll come back and do Akewood every once in a while when I'm inspired to. But I feel like if I just do it now to go through the motions for you guys, you ultimately won't like it. But thank you so much for Akewood, and thank you for the last 10 years, and here's what's still going to happen, and blah, 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 but thank you. But instead it's like, I've been through the ringer, and I've done all of this work for you, and you don't appreciate it, and I worked for 15 hours, and you consume it in 15 seconds, and even Neil Gaiman agrees that you guys are a bunch of assholes. So fuck you, and take what you want, and keep the RSS feed open, and I'm going to write what I want, and boo-hoo, wah-wah. And it's just like, I just could not believe what I was reading, because
the thing I didn't understand, especially the part about I work for so long on it and it's something that gets consumed in 30 seconds. Well, that's always been the problem.
That
with,
to me,
with
can
comics.
I tell you, that to me is was a bigger red flag that I was like, I didn't quite understand it. It's kind of like that old sitcom joke of like, you knew what this was, you know, like comics. But comics, none of us go into it thinking that someone's going to pour over our painting like it's a Giotto that we need to pour over every brushstroke. You know what I mean? The nature of the art form is quick read.
Well, but, and let's put a finer point on it. Still, don't you get a little bit nervous when you realize that somebody has been spending way too much time reading your comic? Like, when they come up and they can quote punchlines that you can't quote, that you don't even remember having written. It scares me a little bit when somebody spends a little bit too much time reading my stuff.
Right. But, I mean, Robert Frost, if he spends 3 months crafting a poem, does he have any right to be like, hey, you read that in one sitting? You know, it's like, it's only 50 lines, you know? Like,
hey, slow down, buddy. I can see your lips moving.
Yeah, not every art form is a Russian novel to be spent, you know, an entire 7 month winter reading. You know, it's some things are quick reads, and that to me that was sort of like, I don't understand what the criticism of comics there is. Not totally separate from web comics, it's a critique on, well, yeah, it's a 15, 30 second read. What when was that any different 10 years ago? You know.
Also, I've seen his art. It's not taking him 15 hours.
I think a lot of that is potentially process driven. Like, we don't know what the process is. Do you remember, Scott, there was a cartoonist, and I don't remember his name now, but he did a 4-panel, and it was very comic book art, but it was super clean. It was almost Bruce Timm-like. But I remember reading about he was talking about his process somewhere. And he said, yeah, any given strip, 4 panels will take me between 8 and 10 hours to do. And it was like, and it was flat color, one inking, and, you know, same panel layout. So he's not doing thumbnails of the page or anything. And I remember thinking, God, this takes 6 to 8 hours. Like, why does this take so long?
Yeah.
Like, I could draw this, you know, not that that was my style of drawing, but I could get this done in an hour and a half maximum and shadow it, you know, and shade each thing. So I don't, whatever his process was, it was literally killing him, you know, and making him hate.
So what you're
doing
saying
the
is
work.
We don't realize that Chris Onstad's process is step one, sketch, step two, trace in vellum, step three, ink on light board, step four, trace ink with new sketch. Step eight.
You don't.
Second.
You can't
know. You know what? You're joking. You're joking. But like, have you ever talked to Christopher Baldwin about his process on Space Trawler? I mean,
no.
The reason why it looks so beautiful is there's 9 steps involved. Like he told me, and I was like, Chris, I'm pulling out my hair talking to you. This is so involved.
Well, here's the thing, though. Are the 9 steps?
Some. I guess what I'm saying is, some artists, like this project that I'm working on, has me going into a lot of cartoonist studios, and it's amazing how some people literally can bust out their strip in 15, 20 minutes. And I'm like, damn. And other cartoonists, it's like, all right, we're in hour two of filming your process and there's 6 more hours to go, you know? Like some people's process is just so slow that I actually believe that part of the blog post, that it might take them forever, because who knows?
Well,
you know?
And it 14 of those hours might be writing too.
True, true.
Let me just get this out
true.
Too real quick before we forget it. Oh, absolutely. I want to touch on that. Absolutely. This is something Bill Amon said to me at PAX. He said, he came up to me and he goes, so when you broadcast your strips, when people watch you make the strip, you don't include the part where you write it, do you? And I go, no, that would be boring as shit. That would be people sitting there and watch me just go, oh my God. And he's like, yeah, you start once the hard part's over. And I'm like, yeah, we do. We turn the camera on once the hard part's over. So yeah, that's a good point. The writing is a huge part of the process. And apparently that is absolutely a large part of it, because he is clearly wringing his hands over repeating himself and stuff, you know?
Yeah, well, and to be fair too, I know you don't read it, Scott. It is a brilliant strip, and it's got a voice like none other that I've ever seen. Like,
No. Absolutely. Listen, I want to say publicly, and right now, for the record, I applaud him doing 10 years and saying, done. I want to go write novels now. I have no problem with that. The next thing I'm about to talk about is going to be counter to that. But I understand that if it's not in him, to keep going, he shouldn't keep going. He should go write novels. And I'm my first reaction is that if that's the case, then do it humbly and say thank you and go write novels, you know?
Right.
But for him to write I mean, listen to this. Listen to this, okay? Whatever I put up on Akewood.com is free to the world, and I won't entertain a bunch of entitled whining.
He's already admonishing us for something.
Can I tell you, whenever I read a blog post like that, and even whenever I read like blog posts from you guys or other friends of ours, I don't know if you guys play this game, but I play the mental game of what emails did he receive for that blog post?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because I always think, like, who are you invisibly answering in that blog post that I'm reading right now? And I can imagine what emails he is answering in that blog.
Yeah, I think maybe a lot of the offense that we take at that, you know, not as other creators but as readers, as an audience, might be that, well, he's not saying it to us, and he's not being careful with who he's writing to. He's writing it to the public, but he's treating it as though everybody is going to attack him.
Right, but
listen,
it's also,
I'm sure he's already been attacked,
though.
What Dave is saying.
Yeah,
oh,
so,
no, absolutely.
Chris, what I'm saying, Chris, is that he's writing to, I don't know, 20, 40, 100,000 people, but he's really writing to five people that pissed him off in an email 20 minutes earlier. Do you know what I mean? And,
right.
Like, we've all been guilty of that at various points, and I just think you got to be really careful not to answer the squeakiest wheel in your inbox, because that's not your average reader, and you don't want to – I don't know. To Scott's point, you want to be kind about it, you know?
That's a really good takeaway.
No, it's true. I've got two Twitter accounts. I have mine, and then I've got one that I made for Chainsaw Suit, just for Chainsaw Suit, to announce when a strip is up and things like that. But my – personal account has 10,000 followers, and my Chainsaw Suit account has 600. So if I tweet about a new comic going up on my account, then it's going to reach a lot more people. One person, when I did this, when I tweeted that a new comic was up from both accounts, he said, "Hey, I already follow the Chainsaw Suit one. Let me know if you know." And he's like, "Are you going to do that for everything? Are you going to duplicate that content? Because I'm just going to stop following Chainsaw Suit." And my reaction was, well, I should really use Chainsaw Suit for that and not this one. But one guy complained about it.
Right.
No, it's going to be much more beneficial to me if I do it from both. And if he doesn't like it, then no. Then,
yeah,
don't
follow.
Yeah,
but you know what? In an article on, I think it was Newsarama or something, where they interview Onstad about this, or Comics Alliance or whatever, they ask him about feedback. And he says specifically you can't pay attention to that stuff. So he knows better. That's not what this is coming from. I really think he is feeling super entitled right now. Here's another thing, and this is the point I want to get to, okay? Brad and I were talking about this yesterday, and we were discussing – I'm reading the autobiography of Hank Ketcham, okay? Fantagraphics republished it. It's called The Merchant of Dennis, and it's his autobiography. He wrote it, and – there's a passage here I want to read. And I don't know, Dave, you just recently talked to Pastis, right?
Yeah, Stefan. Yeah.
Did he tell you the story about meeting Sparky?
Yes.
And where he was like, come back when you've been doing this for
10, 20 years, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I found that really interesting. But there was a thing in here. This autobiography, by the way, is fascinating. But Ketchum was doing cartoons in the Army and post-Army, and then he sent in Dennis, and his editor said, I think we have a sale, and then things kind of took off for him. And I know those days are gone where once you get into 50 papers, you can go buy a ranch in Carmel like these guys did. And, I mean, I was telling Brad, you know, it's amazing how – there was a time where if you got that call from your editor that said, I think we have a sale, within the next year you were buying a fucking ranch in Carmel and right. making a fake lake, and that was your problem, you know. And Brad's,
I can't,
like,
get these koi to stay put.
that's what's in this book. But Brad's point was that, well, yeah, but I'll take what we have over that, because, you know, it was only maybe a handful of people that got to break in like that. And I said, well, yeah, but it's like when we watch Mad Men and we go, I know that maybe it wasn't the best time for everyone, but I'd be okay. You know, I'd enjoy being in Mad Men times. I'm a white male. You know,
right.
What I'm saying is I don't think that there are more people now breaking in comparatively than there were then. I think it's the same percentage of really talented people that have a perfect combination of the talent, the drive, and a unique voice, and being in the right place at the right time, that get to do it and continue on as there were then. It's just a different model now. True. You know what I mean?
Well,
how do you guys feel about that, Dave and Chris?
I think you are broadly speaking right. It's almost impossible to quantify how many because, and I was talking with pastors about this, is that I, like you, all the four of us, and maybe a couple dozen others, are like the most keyed in people into the world into webcomics and who's making a go of it, who's doing it. And yet every once in a while, I will stumble across a webcomic where it's like, I've never heard of you, and yet you have 100,000 followers and you're making $250,000 a year. Who are you? How are you doing this? Like when we discovered the oatmeal, I was the same way. I was like, who are you that I've never heard of you and you're
right.
700 times bigger than I am. So right. Sometimes I think worldwide there might be more people than traditional syndicate models allowed for that I've just never heard of. Like specific niches or in very specific audiences that you or I have never heard of.
I think that a lot of that also is responsible for all of these concerns and issues like with process and writing, and that the internet made comics open to a lot of outsider artists right. Where, you know, like, in my example, like I use Flash to draw everything. Why? Well, because it was a tool that I had, but it's not for that. Yeah, but nobody was there to tell me to not do that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. And I don't know what Onstead's process is, but it looks like he uses some kind of vector too, with a fixed width line and all that.
Right.
But if his process could be trimmed down by 60% and save him all that time, there is nobody there to tell him that.
The point I want to make is that process or no, and I think that yeah, there's a good chance that there might be more, but I don't think it's that much more. The point I'm trying to make is that the window of opportunity for you to be a person that gets to strike lightning and make a living for a year as a cartoonist this way, the opportunities are so slim. And for every one of you that get to do it, there are hundreds who will work three times, four times as hard, find a way to keep that gag fresh every day and never succeed. For you to willingly quit in an entitled huff is a slap in the face to everyone that will never fucking make it. And you need to at least think about what you're giving up when you step away from it. I mean, for God's sake, to be able to make that much money being a professional cartoonist and then bitch about it being hard? Yes, it's fucking hard. Fuck you. It's called a job. If it was easy, everyone would get to do it. I'm sorry.
Well, you know what, though?
It's hard.
I have to.
You're stripped fresh.
I got to.
Boo hoo.
Well, and you know, that's. I want to loop around real quick.
Hold on, Brad, can I? Because unfortunately, I have to jet, and I'm so bummed because this is the best conversation we've had in weeks. But can I make one point before
go,
I go?
Go, go.
Because I think this plays into it, Scott, about the idea of making a lot of money. Is that I think that this is a similar case to one we've talked about before, whereas, oh, finally, a big publisher has picked me up. Now I'll finally get my just desserts. And once again, we see that, buck a book. Well, I guess I didn't make a living in that path either, you know?
Right. Yeah.
I think that has a big part to play in a lot of people's mentalities. They're waiting for the publisher to pick them up, when in fact that's a whole business model that is falling apart. And even in its best of days, there are New York Times bestsellers that are barely making a living because you're getting a buck a book, you know?
Right. Yeah, well, we've talked to all kinds of people and told them that, you know, there's no turning point where, oh, I did it. Now I'm in. Now I can relax.
Right.
No,
right.
There is no one event that is going to secure your career. You have to have 30 events each year, and they're all different, that is going to keep you afloat that year.
But we've seen like a half dozen web cartoonists now who are like, finally signed. Here's where, you know, and yes, you got a $60,000, $80,000 signing bonus. And yes, you got, you know, you'll make, I don't know, let's say you shoot the moon and you make 40,000 book sales. Well, great, you got 40,000 bucks. That ain't going to carry you the rest of your life, you know? It's
right.
Back,
right.
It's back to the
grindstone. 3 years from now, you're stuck.
Listen,
yeah.
More than likely,
it was an advance and not a signing bonus.
True. That's true, actually.
But the advance, it's the advance you got to look there, and there's a big difference between the two. Go ahead, Scott.
And before you go, David, I had my two ad guys over here called me into the office to have a little come to Jesus talk, and they said, "Hey, Scott, you know, you told your readers you were going to PAX and you weren't gonna print strips for the week you were gone." And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "And then you got sick at PAX and you told your readers that you wouldn't be posting strips this next week because you were sick." And I said, "Yeah, but I mean, my readers have come to a point where they really appreciate the work I give them, and they let me take that time off." And they go, "Well, they listened to you. They did not come to the site for 2 weeks, and your traffic has tanked. And I'm sure they have no problem with it, but the advertisers that we promised page views impressions to this month are going to have a problem with it because we may not reach the impressions that we promised them." You know,
that's interesting. Yeah.
And I felt devastated. I felt like, what a fucking rookie mistake. Why the fuck did I let myself get that comfortable? First of all, I should have a buffer so I can go to PAX and be sick. Second of all, I should have scrambled anyway. Sick? Who gives a shit? I get to do this for a living. I'm going to fucking go. I'll draw from the hotel room. I'll draw sick. What the hell am I thinking? You know, I mean, this was me going to PAX and me being sick, and which are two legitimate things. But what I'm saying is, I beat myself up. Chris was even like, "Jesus, Scott, take it easy." You know.
But you came back from that meeting like, "It's the end of the world. I've destroyed my family. Nobody's coming back."
No, well, but also
no, but
I feel
the, but
like
the realization
I,
hit
I
you.
I feel like I had let a lot of people down. I let myself down, let my family down, let my readers down. Right. I let down every kid that wishes they were me so that I could take a week off. And, you know, even Koo was like, "Scott, you know, you took that week off so you could go make money somewhere else. Don't forget you worked that week. You know, you were there every day for 9 hours at that booth selling stuff." And, you know, and I'm like, "Thank you. That helps me. But I still let everybody down." Mm. You know, and then I come and read, you know, Chris Onstad's post, and I want to fucking strangle a wild boar just to put my anger in it and sacrifice.
Right. I want to be in this conversation. I got to go, guys. I'm so sorry. But keep going. Man, damn it. I could talk about this all day.
We'll continue it later. Chris or Dave, will you?
No.
Will you go out?
Yeah, you guys keep talking. I just got to go. But if you want to do it later in the day, I will be back. I'm so sorry about that. But you guys keep talking.
All right.
No worries. No problem.
All right. We'll sorry, see guys. Bye-bye.
Let me read you something from The Merchant of Dennis, The Menace, the autobiography of Hank Ketcham. Producing a daily newspaper feature that concerns itself timely is a joy. There are the unrelenting deadlines, to be sure, but there are no restraints to pouring on the steam and accumulating a fat backlog of material so you never fret about coming down with the flu or give a second thought to zipping off on a jaunt to the Caribbean. I struggle to stay 8 or 10 weeks ahead. But my dear departed wacky colleague Vip Parch was more than 2 years ahead when his life was so tragically snuffed out. Alex Graham, the talented little Englishman from Rye, the creator of Fred Bassett, is always more than a year in advance of his release date. How I would love to be in that position of utter leisure and relaxation. My longest lead time was 16 weeks. When I sailed off on my maiden voyage to visit Russia many moons ago. And even then I ran out of cushion and had to hole up in various hotels to maintain the schedule. Maybe if I simplified my style a bit, worked with stick figures, and didn't get so fussy with details. Nah, forget it, Henry. It wouldn't be fun anymore, and those marvelous, flattering letters from art students would cease forever. That does not sound like a man who feels like he's compromising. And Dennis the Menace certainly repeated itself. Now, if a person who lives in a world where you're lucky to have a job cannot find joy in occasionally repeating yourself when you get to do this for a living, then you need to take some of the money you made from your latest Dark Horse book and get some fucking therapy.
Well, there's that.
And now I feel better because I got it out.
Well, can I circle back to the Mad Men conversation?
Mad Men would be great because I am a white male and I would be in a fedora and drinking an old fashioned and dying from cigarette smoke and living the life.
Well, wait a minute. The only thing the only thing you're missing is the cigarettes. You've got the fedora. You
that's
got
right. It's already happening.
And you're
oh, that's
living
right.
the life.
Let's go to 7-Eleven.
So let me ask you this, or let me say this about that, because turning it back a little bit, I was saying I would much rather live today than I would in the 1950s. And let me tell you why I feel that way. Because you're right, there are no more cartoonists making a living today than there were back then. And in fact, that was a subject of a post I made at webcomics.com that I was really proud of a while back that talked about why aren't there any more full-time web cartoonists. And the answer was because it's a Herculean task. It's huge, and it didn't get any easier. Self-publishing got easier, but the act of becoming a full-time cartoonist hasn't gotten any easier. Mm-hmm. And here's what I mean about that for me specifically. If it was 1950s and the point was to get picked up by a syndicate, I would have never, ever gotten as far as I've gotten today. In other words, I needed to have that daily experience of doing a comic strip and self-publishing and getting little meager returns for Greystone Inn in 2000 and 2001 and getting the feedback of being able to put a book out and getting, you know, returns on that. Because if you look at my early stuff, it's not anything that would have ever been picked up by a syndicate. You know what I'm saying? But the but the ability to self-publish and build it over a length of time also meant that I got all of that practice along the way, to the point that now when I sit down to write, I feel very confident as a writer. When I sit down to draw, I know I can make the illustration look like what I've got in my mind. I guess that's what I mean in terms of wanting much rather being here than there, because I would have never gotten all of that experience and all that practice otherwise.
Yeah, maybe not. I don't know, Brad. You know? You're a pretty talented guy. That's a thing. We talk about this perfect storm sometimes of what it takes to be a strip cartoonist. And I'm not talking about a cartoonist or an illustrator. I'm talking about this weird subset of what we kind of grew up wanting to be, which is someone who has a daily feature or a weekly feature or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to be the Charles Schulz and you want to be the Jim Davis. And a part of it, as much of it as writing and as much of it as drawing, and now for us, a part of it is business. A lot of it is staying power. I mean, there's a reason why you're still on that daily grind website, you know? I mean, lot of it is staying power and just having the ability to keep at it. And I mean, you can look at it a bunch of different ways. I mean, a part of it might be a delusion too. I mean, it certainly is easier to have that drive when your feature's gaining traction. And I love saying the word feature, even though we don't really consider them features anymore. I like that term.
You like that terminology, yeah.
I do like that terminology. But what I'm saying is there's something to be said about it. Like, I think it's one of the reasons why I'm starting to gain a respect for XKCD and Randall Monroe, because he is really showing me that there is a consistency and a staying power that is exhibited there. You know, he could be someone that sticks around for a long time. And, you know, Brad, you and I were talking about this, about we see, you know, I mean, we're all human beings. So when we see Chris Onstad get best graphic novel of Time Magazine for 2007, you know, it's impossible to be human and not go, I wish I was elected best graphic novel.
Insanely jealous.
But part of you, but I mean, it. I do remember when that happened, when we going, God, Akewood is everywhere. People really, 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 really are talking about it everywhere. Mm-hmm. And one of my first thoughts was, I hope that does not bode bad for him. Because there's something about that big flash that scares me over as opposed to a long, slow burn.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I've said that. I'd much, much rather have the slow build than to have the meteoric rise. You know, I'd rather have something that I've painstakingly built day after day, week after week, year after year, than to wake up one morning and realize that there are 10,000 people reading my strip.
and you don't know why.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, to a degree.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, that's exactly it. It's like right now, if somebody reads my strip, I know why they're reading it. It's a number of factors, and I've kind of, you know, picked that up along the way. But could you imagine, like, some of these people that have experienced success so quickly, and success that like I said, it makes me very jealous. Let's not gloss over that. Extremely jealous over that kind of success.
I'm gonna say it one more time. Extremely jealous.
But seriously, I'll own that. I will completely own that. But
sure.
But at the same time, it's like, yeah, maybe 10 years of slow build is the better way to go. And maybe that's the thing that some of these people that might be listening to the podcast need to hear, who are also experiencing the pain of being in the first year of a what may end up being a 10-year slow burn.
Yeah.
You think?
I would prefer that too.
Yeah, possibly.
It's not so bad. But here's I don't want to feel like let me parse it to you this way. What we're seeing here in this example of Chris Onstadt is somebody who has very much embraced the creative aspect and has tried to distance himself from the commerce. In other words, didn't run ads on his site. He dealt with a publisher for his books, did he not?
Yeah.
Dark Horse, yeah.
Dark Horse.
So he's really tried to kind of set up that buffer, tried to distance himself for the commerce. Let's say that you had somebody like that who had that same amount of creativity, who had embraced commerce more. But he still has that same...
I don't understand this. What makes you think that Chris Onstadt is not embracing commerce?
But the fact because that he doesn't run ads on his site would be number
I think that you have a lot of... There are a lot of hang-ups associated with this, and I'm really interested in the idea that webcomics, because it's not a formal discipline, it's one that grew up, that everybody essentially is an outsider. We all saw comics in the newspaper and wanted to be that, but there was no school that we went to that taught us any of this. A lot of people making webcomics said, all right, well, I have MS Paint, you know.
Yeah.
I have Notepad. I can make a comic. I can figure out how to make a website. I can put it up on GeoCities. There's no professional aspect to it. It just kind of grew out of, I want to make a comic strip.
Sure.
But at the same time, nobody knows how any of this stuff works. And I think that we have our rituals and our hangups. So yeah, absolutely, Akewood had books. And there's no way to say this guy was terrified of commerce, because he engaged in it, absolutely. But there are still aspects of it that, for whatever reason, people cling to and say, well, I wouldn't be a real artist if I did it that way. I refuse to run ugly ads on my website. And my feeling, especially about advertising, is, all right, I can respect the pure artistic act of never running ads on your website. But what if that ad money kept you afloat? And, you know, and what if now in 8 months you say, well, I got to get a day job. And now it's going to be even harder to make my work. Because 10 hours out of the day I'm commuting or at a desk. And all you had to do was put two ad units on your site and compromise your art that way. And then you get to do it for much longer.
Right.
What's wrong with that?
Well, I guess that's my question. But I don't know what the answers might – I don't know that the answer is obvious either. Here's the question that I was working towards. You've got that same amount of creativity, but you embrace commerce more.
Mm-hmm.
Do you end up in the same point? In other words, let's say that you introduce a little bit. You are a Chris Onstadt type character who comes to the same point after 10 years, but you've been running those two ads. Do you react any differently?
I think you might. I think it would provide you more of a buffer, and maybe I don't know that Akewood is as monetized as it could be. So if he was able to turn around and see even more money in his bank account, maybe that would be a kind of a reminder, oh, all right, well, this is why I'm doing it. It's doing well for me, and I can work it out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at, like, I just printed a fourth Star Slip book, and it's sitting in a warehouse right now. I need to get I need to build a store and connect it so that I can sell that stuff, because I refuse to do it by hand this time. I've got the product right now. I just don't have a means to sell it. If I was selling that right now, I wouldn't feel down on Star Slip. You know what I mean?
Right.
If I had given the audience a means by which to support me, then yeah, of course I'm going to feel better than if I didn't. So I think if he had ad units on his site and had been able to, you know, bring home another, even if it was another $500 in a month, every month, I think it would help. It would feel better.
Chris Onstad had a store at Amplifier like I did. I don't think he was hurting at all. I mean, I think that maybe what happened, and it would be really interesting to see the numbers just because I'm, you know, I like crunching those numbers. But what I'm saying is I think what might have happened is that we had that weird thing we were talking about where maybe there was a drop off. Maybe the quick burn of popularity for Akewood dropped, and when that money dropped, it became more and more difficult for him. It would certainly affect me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But sure. Anyway, I think we've said what we need to say about it, and I have something also more interesting to talk about, or something equally as interesting to talk about that Chris or Brad and I wanted to maybe touch on.
Okay. Oh, are we going to do that?
You wanna?
Let's. Oh my God, we're going to be here for another 45 minutes, but let's do.
I mean, I'm getting hungry. I'll try to shoot it down as fast as I can. Don't worry.
You're not even in the office. Are you coming in today?
Yeah, I am. What do you mean? Why does hunger mean the office?
I don't know. Don't eat without me.
I don't want to, but I'm going to have to get down there at some point. Anyway, go ahead with your story.
Okay, so now I got to find it. Brad, I can't find it now.
Oh, no, I don't know that I'll be able to find it at all. I might not.
Oh, my God. Thanks for listening to Webcomics Weekly, everybody.
Oh,
hold on.
Let me put, wow, Chris. Let me put
one keyboard.
Sorry.
You notice how I've been real irritable lately.
This is all going to get edited in post.
Yeah.
All
no, okay.
Get edited in post. We got an email. Brad and I got an email from a guy who wanted us to look over a contract he got from a collective, and we didn't feel comfortable reading the entire contract because usually when contracts are sent, they're confidential. And but he had a problem with a couple of paragraphs that just seemed odd to him. And so we said we would be comfortable with him sending over those paragraphs, or at least the part of the wording that he had an issue with. Mm-hmm. And so I said, you know, we should really read this out loud on Webcomics Weekly, as, you know, I don't know if it's a real contract. I don't know if it's, you know, allegedly this is a contract he got offered by a collective, and he was asking why would he want to sign this.
And the point being that it's interesting to parse down. In other words, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be going through some of these passages, whether this is a real contract or not, just in terms of how you discuss whether a contract is good or bad.
Sure, sure.
All right.
All right.
So taking it from that, have you found it yet?
So, yeah, I did find it. I did find it. And I want to make sure that I don't read anything I'm not supposed to. All right. So the first paragraph that this guy was concerned about, or girl. All paragraph. This is paragraph X, and it is titled Exclusive Rights. During the term of this agreement, Creator agrees that Collective is the sole worldwide distributor, the sole worldwide digital publisher of Creator's comic, the property.
Yeah.
This includes, but is not limited to, Internet, World Wide Web, wireless, and other digital publishing formats. Okay.
All right.
So they
are not too much to ask.
They are the sole worldwide publisher. So if you want to put, if this person wants to put their webcomic out there digitally, this collective is the only way they can do it for the term of the contract.
Okay.
And the contract, if I remember right, was good for a year, at which point then you'd have to renew. So you're locked in. Am I right there, Scott?
I'll have to go back and check that.
If I remember right, it was like a – but
yeah, anyhow. That's pretty typical,
that's pretty
right?
Standard. Yeah, they would expect that.
All right. Now – but wireless was interesting because that means
– Phone point, content.
That means phone, and that means – if you want to put it on Comixology or any of these iPads or anything, that counts.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I feel at this point is almost a completely different market. So we pointed that out to this person. Creator must also make their best effort to provide the collective with first rights of refusal on all ancillary rights and licensing rights, including but not limited to books, apparel, toys, feature films, television, electronic games, not applying to agreements entered into before this agreement. The specific details of each individual licensing deal regarding the above ancillary rights are 100% subject to the approval of the creator, who retains complete creative control over the property unless that control is relinquished by the creator. So now, this is what's really weird. So what they're saying is, digitally, we are the sole publisher. In addition to that, you must make your best effort to provide the collective with first rights of refusal on everything else. Everything else is covered by that. So if you want to make a t-shirt...
That's horrible.
Right? But here's what confused me the most. I mean, we told this person that essentially if you want to make a t-shirt, you have to ask them if they will want to make the t-shirt first. If Image Comic comes to you and says, we want to make a comic out of your series, you have to go to the collective and say they want to publish a book. And then – but you get the rights to publish it for the same amount of money that I'm being offered.
On the face of it, that's not such a bad deal because they would most likely have to match that same offer and stuff like that. But let's say if Image wants to print do a graphic novel based on your work, they might have all kinds of resources that this other group doesn't
have. That's a very interesting legal argument. You know, that is a very interesting legal argument because whenever you're offered a first. Whenever you talk about first right of refusal, you're discussing like with the syndicates, right? Like clearly Universal Press Syndicate has pretty much the same influence as maybe United Media. There's not that much of a difference. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking a disparity in influences between a webcomic collective and Image Comics or Dark Horse, you could make the argument that there's no way they could match that because they just don't have the penetration. Legally, I would think. But right. The thing that confused me the most is they must also make their best effort to provide first right of refusal. Why would you put that in a contract?
It doesn't sound like it was written by a lawyer.
You guys well, yeah. try really what is, hard.
What is best make effort?
Really hard try.
Make a hard try.
Make
I don't
super
think
hard try times.
Really get it in there. Really make it seem like you're doing your job.
It almost feels like they're saying, if you don't ask, we won't take it. But we want it gassed. At least make us feel good.
It would be nice to be asked.
Kind of like how I felt about prom. You know, I don't necessarily want to go with you.
Going.
But I'd like to be the one to say no.
Well, but anyway, I mean the rights, the paragraph of rights is what I always check out first, and it was just very interesting that first right of refusal, because if you look this up, there was two different things. There was first right of refusal, and then there was another one, right? It was
second right of refusal.
We reserve the right.
We have to get right. Four rounds.
Can I go back just before I stomp on your punchline? I'm sorry, Chris.
No, it's okay.
Look at that phrase carefully, Scott, and I don't mean that to sound condescending. Is it first right of refusal or is it right of first refusal?
It says creator must make their best effort to provide collective with first rights of refusal on all.
Isn't that supposed to be right of first refusal?
I think
this document has not been written by a lawyer.
Maybe it has.
I don't know. Because I think he's right. I think it is right of first refusal.
Well, and what Chris is saying is something that maybe came across my mind too. In other words, when it comes to a legal document, that's a very important distinction to make between whether it's the right of first refusal or it's the first right of refusal.
Because the right of first refusal, it's done. Yes, they get the right to refuse it first, finished. It implies one. First right of refusal implies that there's a second right of refusal somehow. It's not good language.
I don't know that.
Don't think that's a term.
I don't know that it matters.
I think it matters considerably. They have to nail that down. I mean, you said so yourself. The other piece of language was they have to make their best effort. That's nonsense.
No, I know.
No court can determine best effort.
So the other thing that was interesting was the payment. The payment. Okay. And this was really interesting, and it's something that new creators should – when Brad and I read this paragraph, we were like, I was like, wait a minute, Brad, listen to what this is saying.
Is there a necessity to give the absolute number, or are we just going to talk about it as a concept?
Well, yeah, maybe
can we talk about the percentages?
Basically, the first thing was the collective was offering them a flat rate to sign on. What we pointed out was that it was an advance. Well, right. It was a pretty nice advance, but it was an advance. It's not a signing bonus. It's not a congratulation. Here's a gift. It's an advance.
And what's the difference between profits. And this is something that we touched on earlier in the podcast. What's the difference between an advance and a signing bonus?
An advance is. Neither of them do you have to pay back necessarily, right?
Right.
A signing bonus is just a gift, and you get that in addition. An advance is money that you get that you're not on the hook for. It's not like, well, if your book doesn't make that money back, you owe us. You keep the money, but you will never make any more money until we earn profits that equal the advance given to you. Then you will earn profit after that.
Right,
it's an advance against your future profits.
Right. That's the more accurate way of saying it. In other words, you know that you're going to be making profits. They're going to give you a certain chunk of that profits up front. When you pass that mark, then you start making money again.
And someone in the chat room is saying some advances you actually do have to pay back unless the contract says you don't.
That is true. I have heard about that, especially in book publishing. If your book doesn't make a certain amount, you have to pay your advance back. That's an absolutely factual statement. I don't know that it applies necessarily to this contract, but that's a factual statement.
Someone in the chat room is also saying the best effort is legalese, and it's saying that best effort applies to when you don't have control over all the channels. But best effort is that you will control the channels you do have control over.
Oh, I see.
Oh, that makes sense.
So there you go. Right. There's the best effort. So a lawyer could have written it. But regardless, you have to give them first right of refusal.
Right, all right, first refusal.
refuse of right, refuse. So the advance was the one thing, but then here's the thing. So the way that the payment works with this collective is that you're required, if you're on this a member of this collective, to have 3 ads on your website. Okay? 3 ads per page.
Okay.
They will provide the ads for you, and they will collect the money for those ads.
And sure.
You will receive 50%
Okay.
50% of any and all revenue derived from the rights outlined in Article 2.
Okay. All right.
Which was the article we just read, right? So they split any profits they make, they split in half. Now, one of the things that they say later on in this paragraph is that you are paid for the advertising based on the number of page views, based on their internal stats.
Based on page views and not impressions?
That's the key. Not ad views. Page views.
So you have, so you're carrying 3 units on your page and you're getting paid for half of one of them.
Yes, that is the key.
And not half of 3 of them.
You're getting paid for one half of the you're getting paid for one half of 1/3.
Right, and that's what this person missed reading it. Was 3 ads are going to run on their site per page, but 3 ads equals 1 page view. So
right. 18 ads would be 1 page view if they had 18 ads.
Exactly. So you're not getting paid 50% of the revenue generated by 3 ads per page. You're getting paid for half of one of the ads.
Yeah, that's horrible. Horrible deal.
Yeah, don't sign it.
No, don't sign that.
Not to mention the fact that at this point in time, there's no benefit to being with a collective, really.
Well, I think the one thing that – I mean, the ad stuff makes me mad. But, I mean, the first refusal thing makes me super nervous because when I was with Keenspot, they had a right of first refusal, which I didn't have a problem with. But what I didn't realize was that they can say, oh, yeah, we'll take it. I wanted to make a Checkerboard Nightmare book, and they said, oh, no, we'll do it. It's okay. Right of first refusal invoked. We will print the book for you. No problems. And then so I made a book, and I sent it, and it didn't get made. And it was just delayed. And I could have made that. I could have turned 2 books around in that amount of time, and instead I had 0 books.
Jeez.
So how do you know that they're not going to invoke that right just to keep you?
Yeah,
yeah, well, we're interested, but it has to go into our timetable, and that's 3 years from now.
Right of first refusal is a contractual right that gives its holder the option to enter a business transaction with the owner of something according to specified terms before the owner is entitled to enter into that transaction with a third party. It differs from right of first offer. And in the right of first offer, that merely obliges the owner to undergo exclusive good faith negotiations with the rights holder before negotiating with other parties. First offer is an option to enter a transaction or exact an appropriate transaction terms. A right of first offer is merely an agreement to negotiate.
Yeah, that's much preferable.
It just means you can negotiate. It means
let us get our pitch in there.
Yeah.
Hear us out first.
Right of
not it's ours to refuse.
Right. Right of first offer I have no problem with. Right of first refusal is tricky.
It means that you're asking for your rights back.
Yes.
They have them.
Yes. Right of first offer means you at least give them a chance.
No, I agree that especially as far as collectives go, that I don't think there's a lot of value in a collective anymore. Especially not under these terms, which are miserable.
You'd be surprised, though, on webcomics.com, this topic comes up from time to time, and there are a lot of people that are hell-bent on joining collectives still.
Well, it's just like hell-bent on, I hope a syndicate picks me up. There's an air of legitimacy.
Yes.
And that makes you feel like you made it.
Somebody is accepting you.
Right. And that's what we're waiting on.
Yeah.
But it doesn't exist anymore. Certainly not like it did.
Well, no, there's no more. Exactly. There's no more. And you know, you almost wonder, kind of like Mad Men, whether it ever was really that way. You know, there was always a little bit of that, but it's like, was it ever you sign and then the Brinks truck backs up?
I think for some people it was, but I think that back then it wasn't. It was either you sign and either a Brinks truck backs up or nothing really happens and you get a pittance every month, or nothing, because there's absolutely no other venue. There's no other way to make this happen.
Right.
You can either sign and take your miserable, $4 a month. Sorry, that's the best you get. Or you get $0 a month and you never get anywhere. So, yeah, I think it's completely changed now.
Well, anyway, it was a good show.
We talked about a lot of important stuff.
We did. I feel like we really covered the world.
I'll be honest. I feel like it really picked up as soon as Dave left. Yeah. I felt a buoyancy. We were able to start to really ford these rivers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
It really is interesting.
And clearly, we three of us really are the ones who cared enough to stick around.
I miss David already. Hey, now that Dave's gone, let me say something about Dave. I received a thank you note from David and Fred
for
participating. I know, and I opened it up. Angie goes, here, this came for you in the mail. And I'm like, oh, from Sheldon. I go, God damn it, you know what this is? And she goes, what? And I said, this is a fucking thank you card for doing the interview. And she goes, oh, that's nice. And I'm like, God damn it, this is why I'm jealous of Dave Kellett. Because he has his shit together.
So together.
So together. Like,
oh, I know.
I would get home and be like, you know what? I don't think we actually recorded that. I don't think I hit the button. He's sending out thank you notes. A classy thank you note.
Yes.
Yeah. And what do you normally do when you get a card as a mail? You
throw it away.
Oh, that's nice. Toss. I actually kept it. Like, no, I need to bring this to work and put it on my desk and think about it. Like, I need to start. I need to rise to this level of professionalism.
Yeah, he's doing things right. He's doing a lot of things right.
God damn it!
God damn it, Dave!
God damn it, David! That asshole.
But that, and by the way, you know darn well that it's little things like that that's going to make a big difference when this project does come out, because there's going to be a lot of goodwill there. There's going to be a lot of people that want to see this thing succeed. Are we allowed to talk about it? I'm parsing my words as if it's a secret. Are we allowed to talk about it?
Well, I think he's posted pictures from the thing. I don't know what the title of it is or anything, but...
So when this documentary comes out, he's going to have no problems getting people on board promoting it, because
no.
He's
no
treating everybody so politely.
He's even
that manipulative son of a bitch. He knows exactly what buttons to push.
He knew what he was doing all along.
That's the worst part, is I don't think that is in him. I think he's like, boy, I really should send thank you cards out. I think that's deep in his heart.
Oh yeah. Yeah, in all seriously, we've known Dave for a long time and we know that is the truth.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
You know what? I'm gonna send both of you a thank you card. Just for being pals.
I look at Angie and I go, am I supposed to send a thank you card back for the thank you card? Like, how do I and she just shook her head. I don't know.
I've always wondered if maybe somebody couldn't make a good amount of money selling your welcome cards.
You're welcome.
Oh,
Oh, oh Webcomics Weekly.
You're welcome.
I'm totally serious.
It just says you're welcome, and then when you open it up, it's a picture of me winking at you. and I had them. Someone in the chat room says, my pleasure card. My pleasure.
Well, that's a completely different kind of card. It's got a completely different...